welcome back to the Sex Power Money podcast with me, Sarah Pascoe. Today I've got an incredibly fascinating guest. Her name is Denisha Anderson. She's an artist, filmmaker and a DJ, which we don't actually cover very much today. Her work explores the key themes of identity, race and gender, tying into social documentary, fashion and portraiture. Her craft has led to exhibitions at the V&A, national residencies, international magazine features, followed by the limited publication of her book, Bikes and Bridges, followed by the zine, The Cock Chronicles, which I currently have in my hands. Don't be jealous. She also has a monthly radio residency on Bellamy, with recent guest features on NTS and Represent. What was it about photography that attracted you?
Well, basically, it kind of found me, like, by accident. So when I was applying for college, you have to have four options. One of them was performing arts. And when I got there, they were like, we don't do that. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's definitely on this page in your prospectus. So I was sitting opposite this geezer that was like, well, you have to pick a subject. And he's reeling off loads of different subjects. Then he got to film studies and I was like, what you got to do in there? And he's like, I don't know, you just watch films. I think it's pretty easy. And then I was like, all right, then I'll do that. And then I started to learn about the different departments in film more with an emphasis on cinematography. Then I ended up going to film school. And to get into that film school, I had to have a little portfolio. So I bought a camera.
Yeah.
And that's the rest of it, to be honest.
I kind of like that, because rather than it being like, oh, I definitely had this path I wanted to do, you just reacted to your environment and then was like, oh no, I like doing this thing. You could have been in the musical theatre in the West End if their prospectus hadn't lied. Yeah, you'd have been in like Les Mis or, you know, Holding Spears at the RSC, a completely different life.
Could have been, but I'm happy with the life that's that's been painted for me. Yeah,
I know, it's a happy story. So in terms of your projects, because I really want to talk to you about masculinity, and obviously that's a topic you're really interested in. When did you become interested in like men as subjects for taking photographs?
I just moved back to London because I used to live in Amsterdam. And I was dating this geezer and we went to an exhibition in the Oxo Tower. And there was one floor which was called the explicit floor. So then you get on this floor, it's on the third floor, and it was just different interpretations of the female figure by men. So it was either so it was in the formats of photography, painting, illustration, graphics, but it was female nudes.
Yeah.
And first of all, I was a bit like, are you taking a mick? Like, in terms of an explicit floor, why is it only the female figure? And then there was one wall, and I would have put money on it being, captured by a man. And then when I read, like, the little information, it was by a woman, and I just felt really upset that a woman couldn't even photograph herself or her female subjects without it being overly sexualized. And so this whole experience kind of just like wound me up a bit, and I was just like, okay, we need to look at the body in a different format, and we need to look at the male body, because we obviously don't see it enough.
No.
So then that's basically what sparked the whole thing.
So it was more of like an interest of balance. You're like, okay, we've done women, they've been done, now let's look more closely at men. Yeah,
but also because there was a point where I just felt that my day-to-day interactions on the road, if I interacted with a stranger and it was a man, it was like really sexually aggressive. There was just like one period of my life that was just really intense, and I was just like, my purpose isn't to wait for a man to decide whether he wants to have sex with me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And especially if there is an intimate interest on both parties, I want to be addressed with respect. And there was a period where this just wasn't happening.
Okay.
So it just kind of all came together as one thing. And I was like, okay, I need to move this narrative along and look at and try and approach it in a different way to create a wider discussion, really.
Yeah. That's so interesting what you're describing about there being a period of your life where So in terms of like you were open to dating, like you were meeting people because you wanted to like potentially be interested, but their behavior was aggressive, like, and
yeah personally. But this wasn't just for dating, this was just like even in a working environment, you know, yeah. where, and I just felt that there was always an opportunity for someone they'd see to like flirt with me, and this is a professional setting, and it just kind of just wound me up over a period, you know?
Yeah, of course, of course. So you're kind of getting bombarded in that way. And then, so what you sent me before we've spoken is, so I've got the Cock Chronicles in front of me. And what's so interesting about, so talking about the things that you've written in there first, because what's so interesting is some of those interactions I thought were quite aggressive. Like when you first posted on kind of Tinder and Grindr saying, oh, hey, I'm a photographer, here's my project, you were getting very sexual messages back from people straight away.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, I expected it because it's a dating app, you know? It's a hookup app. So I expected that. But, you know, because what I'm putting out there wasn't sexual, I thought at least it wouldn't be too much, but it did get really intense in certain places.
Yeah.
So I had to have a little time out from the apps.
But the thing is, you say that about it like being hookup apps, but I think some people, obviously not Grindr, but I think some like Tinder, I could imagine like, you know, just like a divorcee in her 50s thinking, oh, I'd like to meet somebody new. I'll go on Tinder. And then I think some people, I wouldn't be prepared for those kind of messages.
But when Tinder first came out, it was a dating app. But like over the last year or 2 years, in terms of their advertising, they've rebranded it as hookup.
Okay.
So that's why I'm saying that.
Yeah.
So like it definitely has had a transition. So if you are that 50-year-old divorcee, if you didn't catch it before its rebrand, you are going to have a heart attack. Yeah.
Yeah. So then she's going to have to go on Plenty of Fish or something like that instead. Is that a bit?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't encourage that either. Yeah,
oh, really? Either. Okay. Maybe just go to your local wine bar, Marjorie. Just go and meet people in real life. Why don't you get a hobby like pottery? Something like that.
Yeah.
That'd be safer.
Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. There might be a little Patrick Swayze kind of scenario.
Perfect. So when you decided to do the Cock Chronicles, can you tell me what your kind of overriding, what you wanted to achieve from it?
Okay, so basically the Cock Chronicles is a zine, and it's a collection of Polaroids that I've taken from my sitters that have chosen to take part. And the Polaroids are specifically the penis. So it's all uniform and it's all different body shapes and sizes. And amongst that is a collection of quotes and conversations that I have with my sitters throughout. So it's people that I met up with, who I hope to shoot, people that I did shoot, and people that I never will ever shoot because they're really, really weird. So that's the collection of it.
Yeah.
And the reason why I made this zine is because I'm an independent artist. So I wanted to make something that's small, that lo-fi, that people could invest in, so then I can reinvest in my project, really. So that's the reason why I've done it. So it's just to get information, exposure, and some funding to go back into it, really.
Yeah. How did you feel the first time asking a man to kind of like, hey, I really want you to like take your pants off so I can take a picture of your penis? Like, how did you broach that?
Okay, so the first scenario, I sent a WhatsApp out to all of my friends.
Okay, so it's people you knew.
I mean, obviously, like, the numbers on that were really small.
Okay.
In terms of response. So they ran out really quickly. I think I got about 4 or 5 mates.
Yeah.
And then that's when I created my profiles on Tinder and Grindr. Then after doing it probably about close to a year on there, I was like, I need to actually have a sabbatical because I'm starting to actually hate men in terms of how they communicate with me.
Oh, really?
It just got really intense. Yeah. And just in terms of language, you know?
Because your project involves nudity, that then meant that other kind of social politeness has then gone out of the window. Is that what it is?
Yeah, basically, like, you know, I had guys tell me that they would be the best I'd ever had if I chose to cross that line with them.
Oh, God.
And, you know, I had this Scouser, he's my favourite one, and he is a really, really tall white geezer.
Mm.
And he said to me that, you know, you're going to be really surprised when you see me naked. And I said, why is that? And he said, because, you know, I don't conform to stereotypes. And I was like, what stereotypes are you talking about? And he's like, you know, like, well, I've just got a big knob in it for a white geezer. That's like, you know, like all the rest of my black mates.
Oh my God.
And I was just like, what? And I was like, how do you know that about your black mates? Like, are you engaging in intercourse with them? Then he's like, don't be stupid. And I was like, well, I don't understand how you know this. And he's like, because, you know, I live with a couple and I play football with some. I was like, so this little handful of men are a representation of all of them on the planet. And he's like, you're making me sound stupid. And I was like, I'm not sure if I'm doing that, but, you know, like, this isn't about the size of your penis.
No, it's such a toxic thing on both sides, because you have this kind of thing where a man thinks that it's something to be proud of or ashamed of, his own penis size, but then the fact that he then thinks it's a racial attribute, and that it's fine to say that, like, that for a white man to say that, he thinks, well, that's a complimentary thing to say about black men, rather than a bigger reflection of kind of, you know, it's like, so like with white women who appropriate. So at least white women, I think, are at least aware of that word, like they're aware that that's a conversation and it's something that you shouldn't do. And that if you do it, it's problematic. But the fact that hasn't filtered down to white men.
No, I mean, well, I mean, it's not going to filter down because, you know, it's narrative that they've created. So how is it going to filter out? Do you know what I mean? Like, I've had quite a lot of conversations about masculinity, and also, like, you know, white men especially are obsessed with the black male body.
Yeah.
Especially like English proper lads, which is an interesting idea. Because, you know, like English lads will, like, you know, get naked, make out of each other, and then be really protesting that they're not gay or have any like queer feelings, which I think is quite interesting. And in that same breath, then they'll mock the male physique, but in the same breath, kind of love it silently. So like, yeah, they take the piss, they're like, oh, you know, you've got this elephant trunk of a penis. But in that same breath, it's like, I kind of want that elephant trunk of a penis. And that's really weird how they play, you know, that balance, yeah.
Well, that's it. So I think there's this massive respect for men, male friends. It's something even that other people will tell you. Like, if someone finds out or thinks he's found out that his friend's got a big dick, they, like, tell you, like, oh, guess, yeah, he's actually found out on the holiday, he's hung like a donkey, or this person's. And it's like they're really proud of it and jealous of each other.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, but it's also derogatory to speak about your friend and say, oh, yeah, like, Michael over there is hung like a donkey. Like, that's problematic.
Yeah,
it's like, really, I was at my friend's wedding 2 years ago, right? And it was beautiful. It was in the Cotswolds. And, you know, like, I was, like, one of, like, you know, three of, like, the black guests there, which is fine. Okay. It's cool. Like, my brother's cool. But, like, I'd never met quite a lot of his friends before, like, the extended lot that he went to uni with. And he has a black friend there who's also really cool. But he wasn't there in this conversation. And all of them were white, and we're all talking about his penis and how massive it was and how scary it was and how it can fill a pint glass flaccid. That was a quote that's really stuck with me. And I didn't really understand what the obsession was, because I got introduced into the group as, oh yeah, this is Denisha and she's doing this project. And then they were all interested in this project, obviously.
Yeah.
And then they proposed, oh, yeah, you should meet this guy. And then only spoke about his penis. Like, he has no other attributes. He doesn't have a brain. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite disrespectful. But in that space, I don't know these people. And I didn't know how to say that, you know?
Yeah, of course. But also, I mean, I think that group of people would have been much more, they would themselves have, like, been uncomfortable if you'd started talking about, like, a woman's breasts, like you're saying, like, devoid of any kind of person. People are much more, again, I think they're much more used to going, oh, hang on, I don't think you should talk about that woman like that. Like, when you're just, yeah, pulling them into body parts. But I think people haven't seen the history of the fetishization of black men's genitals to realize why it's so problematic.
Yeah, and it's also just like a high level of like fetishization, do you know what I mean? Like, and that's something that, you know, it's a difficult one. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, me being a black woman, I've definitely been fetishized like throughout my adult life, you know, on all different scales. So, you know, in that scenario, especially like me, you know, the guy that they were speaking about wasn't there, and I'm the only black person within that group in that period. It's kind of hard to then say, hey, like what you're saying is that actually quite derogatory, and you're reducing this person to like a really small part of their anatomy. Because that's then creating conflict, you know, and then obviously we're going to become reactionary and very defensive when I'm not the one on the attack. So, you know, there's always like a time and a place to really choose those battles. And sometimes, you know, just for my own mental health and just safety, it's just sometimes it's just easier to be quiet, even though being quiet, you know, can be problematic.
I know, but you shouldn't have to go through, like as you said, you were at a wedding. People are allowed a day off. You don't have to go around and educate the white people at the wedding. If that's a black person's existence, like everywhere, you're just literally going, okay, here's a new lesson for the white people today. Here's what you've done.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just saying, you know, like, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's a huge amount. And it's a huge amount. And it must be something that you think about so much with your project. So so go back to like a conversation that you have before you photograph someone. Have you found that men are insecure about the same things? Or like with the Scouser, have you noticed that men who know or believe they have big penises are more confident about being photographed?
To be honest, I haven't actually shot that many people with a really massive penis.
No.
there's only been like a handful. And if they are big, they might be just growers, and I don't know because I'm only interacting with them. I don't think so. I mean, I've got when I asked my friends at first, those who responded, obviously I've never seen them naked, and it's just by chance that they had all quite, you know, large penises.
Yes.
Okay. And they did it for me because they support me and, you know, they want me to do well. So it's like, yeah, for you, I'll do it, innit? So I don't know if they were confident or not in that scenario. But like later on, for the guys that I don't know, not one single person was confident. And it was all a performance. And that's something that I've learned throughout the project in regards to what masculinity looks like in a man. It's all a lot of performance and bravado, because when I eventually get to the house and I shoot them, they are very shy. They are very, very insecure. And, you know, they are very aware of themselves. And when I say aware of themselves, they're very aware of their penis. Like, there are definitely a few men that in the shoot, and I know this is going to sound quite problematic, yeah?
Okay. Yeah,
but it's not as sordid as it sounds.
Yeah, okay.
But there were definitely about two or three guys that I've shot, and every now and again I'd catch them, like if I'm changing my roll of film or like having a little think, like they'd touch themselves or give a little
fluffing it a little bit.
But on a little cheeky one, do you know what I mean?
So,
just to give it a little bit more oomph, and I'm just like, I don't know, like, why are you doing that, bro? And there was a series of, like, when I first started, the first probably about 15 would always say to me, oh, you know, it's a little bit cold in here, so, you know, don't judge me. And then my response was always, well, it is your house, so you can switch on the central heating if you feel cold.
Yeah.
Just to, like, break it up a little bit, you know?
Yeah. But it's so, I find it so difficult to imagine, because obviously they do think their masculinity is reflected by their penis. Like, for it to matter to them that much, like, oh, this is me on a good day, this is me on a cold day, this isn't a true reflection of me. I should probably fluff it up a little bit. Like there's something really like deeply inside them that believes like, okay, this shows me really well, or am I going to be that vulnerability for men who don't feel like they're large? That's why I think the guys are actually quite brave, like some of them.
That's what I wanted to lead into, because like, even though like we started this conversation about, you know, like sexual aggressive language and behavior, like for those who have chosen to be a part of my project with respect for what it's about, they have been very courageous. They've also been very patient, and you know, I am very grateful to them, because I'm not paying them because I don't have any money. And they've taken 2 hours out of their time to get naked for me with no promise of sex afterwards, because that's not a part of the contract.
No.
Either. This, we're doing this in the name of art, you know, in the name of a greater discussion to, I guess, connect us as people a bit more and to see differently and to, you know, give us women a break, and also let men see themselves. That's like a really important thing for me. Like, because men don't see themselves enough, and because they've been taught to perform, you know, to be a provider, to be really strong, to not show emotions, all this kind of stuff. They taught that all their lives. So in this project, my main goal is to show their vulnerability in all angles, you know? So that's why it's important to have a wide range of body types, different ages and races, you know, and sexuality as well.
Yeah.
Even though that's not at the forefront, and you won't know unless I've told you this person is queer, it's just important to have them as a part of the narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess also that's the thing, because that maybe the one place that the male gaze does admire men is in kind of like gay pornography or gay, like as in like sexualized photography. But as you say, yours isn't. So it's looking at a man in a non-aroused state and not aiming to be arousing. And so, and you're right, that's something that gay or straight men haven't had that experience of, like, themselves reflected.
Yeah. But also, like, us women, we just don't see men anyway. Like, we don't see men in a sexual format unless we choose to tune into porn or something.
Mm.
So we're all lacking in these images.
Yeah.
We're all lacking in this perspective of narrative, you know? So,
yeah. In terms of responses to your work, have you ever had like someone of any kind of sexual persuasion being like, oh, I really fancy, you know, like Naked Attraction? The whole idea is that if you look at someone's bits, you might go, oh, that's the perfect dick for me. Have you had anyone who has kind of like looked at your work and gone, oh, number 22, that's my man? Or are people much more mature?
No, people aren't that much more mature. I've definitely had a couple DMs and were like, yo, number 4, number 6, give it to me, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But to be honest, like, you know, I'm a human being as well.
Sure.
So now when I first started my project, because I was so focused on what I wanted to get out there and what I was trying to tell my hypothetical audience, I didn't factor in myself finding one of my sitters attractive. Like, that never crossed my mind.
Yeah.
So then I have this scenario, I'm shooting this geezer and I find them attractive.
Oh.
And I only find them attractive on a physical thing, because they're like, you know, and I'm just like, and I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was that shallow as well.
Yeah.
But... So that was a learning curve. I mean, to be honest, that hasn't happened often, but my very first shoot, I did find them attractive, and then I came home after it. I was like, oh wow, like I didn't expect to feel that way. And then I think during the shoot, because I thought they were like handsome, I kind of repressed that energy because I didn't want my eye to make it feel really sexy, you know?
Yeah.
But then at that same breath, I have to just relax with it, because I mean, that's just how I feel. So it's a bit of a mad one. I don't know if I'm even making, I don't know if I'm even making sense, but.
No, you absolutely are. But I was thinking how much, like with a full portrait, if you had a male artist doing a full nude of a woman, quite often how they feel about that sitter is what they're trying to reflect, but you're trying to take yourself out of it and just take a photograph that isn't about how you feel about the person.
Yeah, but it's a part of the narrative, so that's why I now I can just like accept my feelings for however they are. But I mean, since then I haven't fancied anyone, so
no,
there you go,
it hasn't happened again. How do people feel when, so after you've taken the Polaroid, do you then show it to them, and do they ever have a reaction? Like, does anyone ever really like looking at it? Do sometimes people go, oh, I don't want to see?
Yeah, for sure. They all want to see.
Yeah, okay.
And some of them have asked me to do it again after they've had a little fluff.
Oh.
And that's how I start my shoot, because after I've done the Polaroid, because I need you to just get into it, because when I do the Polaroid, I'm only arm's length.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, I do all my portraits, all full body, and then we chat throughout. I interview them, and yeah, we explore basically different angles and stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
There was one.
The whole period takes about 2 hours.
Okay, so there must be a very intense process for both of you. Like, you must feel like you're kind of peeling layers of them away. And do you feel like then when you leave, you go, okay, I really saw him. By the end, I saw him, like a truer version.
Sometimes I feel like people go backwards a bit. Like, I met a guy who was really cool. We met up in Soho. For a coffee, because I got to vet them. You got to make sure they're not nutters.
Of course. Well, I worry. When you're saying you're turning up at their house with your camera, I was like, this is really dangerous.
No, we first match. If I did meet them via the internet,
sure.
Then I meet them for a daytime coffee, and then I ask them a few questions. One of them also is, why do you want to be a part of this project? And then I learn about them, like their age, where they've come from. And then when I feel comfortable, then we set up another date, and then that's when I go to the house. And I say that some of them go backwards because, I met a guy who was in a very vulnerable state, he's emotionally, he'd lost somebody, and, so it was all a bit chaos for him. So he's very, vulnerable, very open, very raw. And I learned a lot about him and his background in terms of growing up, because he had a few issues with food because of his family and all that kind of stuff. So he's very conscious of his physique. So, and then on the day, all that vulnerability, all his openness had changed into, I'm really hot. I can't wait for you to take photos of me. He just pulled his pants down. He's like, I'm ready. You tell me where you want me to go. So it's very, it was kind of weird because the guy I'd met in the coffee shop didn't feel like the guy that I'm with right now in his house. So I didn't really understand that. I felt like as soon as he got his clothes off, he changed a bit,
Yeah. I wonder if he thought that's what you wanted and he was like doing it for you. Like, okay, I'm going to pretend to be more confident.
I don't know. That one was a bit of a weird one, but, because I also because I recognised it was a performance, I didn't really pander to it. I just carried on talking to him as I did before when we first met. Because I was just like, maybe he's just nervous,
Sure, absolutely. Did you have one person who, when you got to their house, then said, I can't do it?
Yeah, I was there for because I don't know the house and how it's set up. So I look around and, set up all my camera stuff, blah, 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 blah. And then he's like, I'm just not ready yet. I just need to finish doing this. So I was like, all right, cool. Then, 20 minutes go by and I'm like, okay. And he's like, do you know what? I'm just not really. And I was like, all right, cool, no worries. Then I'm like, hey, time's ticking and I've got a lot of things going on. So what are you telling me? And he was just like, I actually really can't do it. I can't bring myself to take off my clothes for you for this project. And I just have to accept it.
Yeah, of course.
And then I was like, okay. So, and then I just packed up my stuff and left, really. And I'm not going to lie, it was frustrating because they lived so far. Oh, my God. It took me an hour and a half to get there.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But it was a learning curve.
Of course. And also, I guess, people's idea of what they can do is different to the reality, thinking, yeah, I can do that. And then actually when it came to it, thinking, I don't feel safe. I feel too vulnerable.
Yeah. And yeah. And also like with him and a few other people, it's just like, oh, my body, like I just feel like I need to work out more before you see me. Like I need to go on a diet. I need to do this. I need to do that. Like I'm a little bit too doughy. I'm a little bit too flabby over here.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear that from men when obviously, not that it is a female thing, but it felt like for a really long time, women were kind of given an insecurity because they were being judged by their bodies. And then what happened is rather than that getting better, it just got worse towards men as well.
Yeah. Because the problem with patriarchy is that like men fall victim to it. So it's a problem for everybody. And like they have feelings too. Yeah. And they definitely are insecure about themselves too. So that's why this project is so dear to my heart, because I know they feel stuff and they know they feel stuff, but they aren't allowed to. So I want this to be the beginnings so they can really be living their authentic selves, you know?
But that's what I think is so interesting is like all of your interactions that you're describing with the guys, you're really seeing the difference between they're like the biggest bravado all the way down to, oh, their complete rawness and insecurity and then back again. Like all these layers that they have to create.
Because I've shot guys who, you know, I've shot a partially blind photographer. He literally has a cane, everything. And then I shot a guy that literally had just moved to London from West Africa. He'd been here like 9 months and he's super tall and lives in the tiniest room in the world. So in just in terms of like scope of ages and races and where people are coming from, it's definitely been eye-opening in places. Like I met this guy who was younger than me, and so he's in his like late 20s and he was going for a divorce. And I was like, what are you doing in a divorce, bro? And this is how he opened in the conversation. And he said to me, because I asked him, you know, why do you want to be a part of this project? And he said, well, I'm going through a divorce and that's because my wife just kept on cheating on me. And I said, you know, what was her reasons for that? And he told me that she told him that she'd done it because they're better looking than him. And that's basically the reason why. And I was like, whoa. And he's like, yeah. And just basically how he felt about himself was at zero, you know?
Yeah.
So he wanted to do this project to rebuild some confidence in himself and to see himself again as who he is, you know, and rebuild on that. So he just wanted to basically challenge himself and like get out of his little comfort zone. And I respected that.
Yeah, I think it sounds so brave. Like that's how you deal with rejection. That's so healthy to go, I'm going to be me. Yeah. And then I'm going to send her a Polaroid of my dick and say, that's what you're missing.
I mean, on the day of the shoot, he was super shy. He's probably one of the most shyest men I've shot throughout this whole project. But it was good. And I asked him how he felt afterwards and he said he felt good. And he said he started dating again as well during that shoot, which was cool.
Oh, that's really nice.
It's just all a bit of a process, really.
Yeah. And so I was reading today, so to talk about another one of your projects, which involves like masculinity and male behaviour, you're doing a project called Daddy-O now, which is about fatherhood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I started at the beginning of this year and I guess it was inspired by my own life and my own relationship with my family, specifically with my father. And the lack thereof, but in that I guess I wanted to explore it as a cathartic process by celebrating fathers that I know personally and other people along the way that are a part of their children's lives and who would do anything for them, and especially when you are a black male, you're always seen as that guy that just abandons his family.
Yeah, there's a horrible like racist stereotype about that with black fatherhood, isn't there?
Yeah, and I just wanted to share that actually that's not true. And that's and it's such an isolated, like really like racist ideal. I just wanted to share like love, black love and fatherly love amongst that as well. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So taking photographs of the dads, do you exactly like with the Cock Chronicles, do you still kind of interview people around like their relationship to fatherhood? So has that been interesting?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually really, really beautiful. So I had a father and his daughter, and I asked them, you know, what's your favourite thing about each other? And, you know, she said, like, my favourite thing about my dad is the fact that he's my dad.
Aww.
And then there's a point where she just turns and looks at him and she just goes, like, oh, I love you, Daddy. And he's like, oh, I love you too. And it's just so cute.
That is very cute. That is very cute.
But, you know, like, just in terms of, like, the fathers, and I asked them, you know, how it felt learning for the first time you're going to be a dad. And, you know, some of them relived it, and it was just like, you know, like I was super scared, like thinking about telling my mum, my heart was like coming out my chest. So it's just like, it's that journey and them learning how to be a father and the different dynamics of having a son and a daughter. And, you know, one of them said, you know, when I accepted I was going to be a father, that's when I started to feel great, you know, like that's when I felt like I really done what I'm meant to do on the planet, you know, like procreate.
Yeah.
And you know, he said, you know, even though my daughter is so much like me, she's very much different because she's a woman. Mm. And I've really understand the meaning of empathy. And I really understand that women really do operate differently, and there needs to be a different sensitivity and approach in terms of how we communicate. And I thought that was really beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, just little bits like that. And these are just like, these are young fathers and older fathers on their journey. So, and I think that narrative also is important to look at and also to be shared.
And also it's like another male story that maybe we haven't, all of us, spent enough time even thinking about. Like, I think you're right. So many people, what they have in the space of a father is either a fractured relationship or no relationship, or they have had stepfathers in their house rather than a biological father, all those kind of things. So we focus a lot on the pain of it because it feels like sometimes a really rare thing, actually, like a dad who's around and like with his kids.
But it shouldn't feel rare because it happens all day, every day around the world. It's just that there's certain narrative that are pushed with certain groups, and that's why there's this disparity and these, you know, like negative stereotypes surrounding it.
Yeah. How has it made you feel about how you feel about fatherhood? Has how you feel about fatherhood changed?
I guess a little bit. I think subconsciously, like in terms of that narrative, even though I had friends who were doing it, I think I believed that narrative a little bit because it was told to me so much. Like, so like, I felt like my friends who were a part of their children's lives, who are, shall I say, were a minority. That's how I felt. Which I guess I never really thought about it until this moment. So I guess that's a thing that I'm digesting right now in this conversation.
Yeah.
But in the same breath, like, it still was important to me, which is why I'd done it. And, I know, obviously, it's not true, so...
Yes.
And I'm happy to say that I'm wrong, you know?
Yeah. But it wasn't something, because seeing really great fathers, or like like what you're describing with that little girl saying that he's my daddy, that can sometimes, if you haven't had that kind of relationship with your father, actually, it can make you feel like a little bit, like, jealous, or like, well, why didn't I get that? Because some people, like, they feel like what's missing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, if you never had it at all, you don't really know what to miss.
No. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you've had something and then it's been taken away, then, yeah, you can 100% miss it. But if you've never had it at all, you're missing like ideas and stories and images that have just been told to you. So you're creating a fantastical image.
Yeah. So your
like,
dad...
For me, like,
yeah.
For me personally, like, you know, he was a part of my life in one part and then, you know, he wasn't for another part. And that's okay. Like, I've accepted that now. But I think I just wanted to see, like, actively, like, how relationships were when dads are a part of it. You know, I wanted to just celebrate it. Even though I didn't have it, I wanted to celebrate it. And also... just to see it and know that that's what I want for, like, you know, my future family whenever that is created,
yes.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's another interesting angle, isn't it? Like that, if that's what you're looking for from a father for your children, it's like you've had a really good research phase to go, okay, that's really good. That's a good quality. Years ago, I did a project for Essex Council and they had some money that had been given to them by the government. And all the local authorities had to decide how to spend it. And as in, it was for children and it was for play facilities in the park. And so what my job was to go into schools and basically we did like hour-long workshops and we were researching what do kids want in terms of equipment for the playground. And the answer will not surprise you, but the overriding answer from all of the groups of children was like your ideal thing for playing was like, I like playing with my dad. I'd like to have more time playing with my dad. My dad has the best games. My dad has the best imagination. Because that was the person that in their environment was the most time poor. Because most commonly, dads work full time. So like kids really like thought it was so precious when like their dad got down on the carpet and played a game with them or was there at the park. And yeah, everyone was just crying all the time. Like they just want their dads. they don't want swings, they want their dad.
Yeah, but I mean like that in itself, like it's a really sad story because I mean the reason why dads aren't about is because of a system that's been put in place.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like maternity leave and like the flexibility with that. So yeah. Like the you know, the system that's been put in place is to encourage like disparity or at least like weaker relationships between like two parents. Because, yeah. I mean, another part of the system is, you know, if I'm in a relationship with a young man and we have a child and I needed just some extra financial support if I was going for, like, a council house, I would get my house quicker and be supported if I was a single mother than if I was actually in a relationship with my partner. And that is a problem. And that is encouraging, like, you know, separation and disparity in terms of relationship building with your child. Of course,
because rather than the government saying, oh, here's a new family, let's support them, because like lots of new families, the beginning is really hard. Childcare is hugely expensive. One or other of you is going to not be able to work as much. And instead of encouraging that and seeing the support that people need, it's going just literally because it looks on a form like you're more vulnerable. If you don't have contact with the father or financial support from the father, now will help you.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, well, the other thing that's really a problem, and I know this because of what happened in my family, but if the mum and the dad really do fall out, like where their kids are young or whether they're divorcing, that the whole thing about access to children and there just aren't spaces for, especially there aren't spaces for men to go with their kids that are cheap. Like the difficulty we found when I was a child was that like, everything costs so much money. And if your mum won't let your dad in the house, like there is nowhere to go. Like you either go and sit on a, like you go and sit in a park, but if it's cold, like there was like really like difficult logistical things. And I always used to wish there was just a space, like a soft play where men could go with their kids and there was access there and you could have cups of tea. But also like, I think people, not even people, society hasn't tried to make that easier for dads who want to spend time with their children. And so the children lose out, actually. Like, that's what can become so difficult. And that, and I know that this is, I'm going to sound like a father for justice now, but if the mum can make it really difficult for dads to see their kids, and then the dads get really angry or resentful, or they just go, okay, I'm cutting off completely.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that, like, you know, with some of my friends who unfortunately have to, like, do custody battles, you know, just to see their child. because of, you know, relationship breakdowns or whatever.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of factors that play into it that ultimately affect, you know, positive like relationship building between parent and child sometimes, especially when it comes to fathers.
Yeah, I know, and it is a really sad thing, because I do understand it. Like, I understand if you've had children with someone and then they've, you know, been a shit, or they've cheated on you, all those kind of things, and then you don't want to be nice to them. You don't want to like make it easy for them to see their kids. Like, they've broke your heart. I can understand why that phase of someone's life is so emotionally difficult. But there, in the long run, unless we support men better and men's access to their children, it is just children that lose, I think.
Yeah, of course. But at the same breath, I think, you know, if you're choosing to have a child, whether it was planned or not, if you're going through with it, once they've come onto the planet, everything you do, in theory, should be a selfless act because you're doing it for them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, if you use your child as a scapegoat or as a little thing to like throw and like, you know, rile somebody else because then they no longer want to be with you or whatever it is, that's not fair. And that creates disruption.
I know. Oh, you're absolutely right. Seeing my friends all become parents, that's when I realised that, oh, parents aren't magic. They're just, they're like, you know, like, I always expected so much of my mum, like, and then realising as an adult, oh, she's an absolute, like, human being with the same kinds of fallibilities. I was like, oh, okay. I just thought you were supposed to take everything and do everything.
Yeah, I mean, crazy.
yeah, really crazy. I wanted to talk about another project I saw on your website because I thought it sounded so interesting. And I think it's called Trip. And you went to Paris and you were photographing. It might not have been called that. That might have been the article. But you went to Paris and you were doing a photography project with trans sex workers.
Oh, yeah, that's called Transformation, that project.
Ah, okay. Yeah, tell me about that.
I basically went to Paris for a long weekend with my housemate who I used to live with in Amsterdam. Yeah. And she wanted me to introduce one of her oldest friends that she made like from like 10 years ago, basically, when she was studying anthropology. Mm-hmm. And her thing was she did groundwork and lived in Brazil for 6 months. And then came into contact with loads of different like sex workers, including transgender ones, and has still been a friend ever since. So because she now has her own charity, she wanted me to like start a little documentary series or the beginnings in sharing the story of her friend, basically.
Yeah.
So in that experience, this was my first time ever meeting anybody who is transgender. And this was like pre Caitlyn Jenner, you know, it was probably like at least about 6 months before. So, I mean, I was excited. I'm always excited to learn new stories and meet new people.
Yeah.
And in terms of that project itself, on paper, it might seem like, oh, this is like really boring. This is the mundane.
Oh, boring. But I would say the exact opposite.
No, but I say that because like, you're not looking at anything extreme. Like, there's nothing that's like gonna like, you know, grab your attention straight away. Like I chose to shoot the mundane because I wanted people to look at these people and be like, they're just people. So
yes.
It doesn't matter about their line of work or their chosen gender. Like they bleed, feel and speak the same as me and you. So that's why I shot it and chose to tell the story in which I did, really.
Oh, that's so interesting because absolutely that's where you've caught me. It sounds really exotic to me, sex workers in Paris who are trans. And then your whole project was stop trying to exoticize things and other them. Like, here they are. It's the same life is what you're saying or what you were showing.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Because, I mean, like, you're only going to get that information, I guess, from my little blurb that I write up.
Yes. Yeah.
So when I have my show, the information is pretty small, you know, and a lot of people don't read it anyway. And I know that. So I like to see how they're absorbing the photos in. And a lot of people only realize that they are transgender when it asks me like who these people are and what they're about, or if they read the information at the end, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh my God. And then there's this whole thing of like, I've been fooled, I've been tricked. And that also isn't the thing. And you also shouldn't absorb someone's gender as being fooled or tricked, you know?
Yeah, which I think is something that goes on with trans people in general. The whole thing of like passing and it being a compliment to say to someone like, oh, but you've got better legs than me, or this kind of thing. And it's like, number one, it keeps reinforcing that like women of all varieties owe everyone prettiness, that attractiveness is the highest goal of all women, no matter what. And yes, there's like an idea of like, oh, you've won at being trans. I wouldn't have known.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about us interpretation.
This is narrative of marginalized groups all the time. Like this is narrative for black women. Like, oh, like, you're pretty for a black girl. Like, you're like, you know, you don't sound that, you know, like you're from that kind of area, though you are black, you know, like you sound quite educated, you know, and that is problematic. That's offensive. And that's, you know, where does that come from? Why is that necessary?
Yeah. In terms of like all of the things that white people are learning are not necessarily complimentary or patronizing. One of the ones I only found out recently was telling a black person, oh my God, you're so articulate, because inherent in that thing is I wouldn't expect that of you. And I think that's why the education around all of that, as you're talking about in like marginalized groups, that's why it's so important, because you don't realize what you're saying to somebody that's about you and your preconceptions.
Yeah, but you know, like, but why did you say that before? Like, why was that language that you use? You know, why? I'm just asking, you know, personally, you know, if you engage with someone, a black male, a black female, and said, oh, you are so articulate, why would you say that? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah, exactly. Because what it means is, which I found a surprise, or it was to such an extreme that I still feel like, Akala talks about it in his book, and it's like, you don't say that to white people. White people don't say, I mean, unless it's extreme, unless it's like Stephen Fry, but you're just talking to people. You don't go, oh, you're articulate, Peter, today. Like, it's not a thing you notice. So watch what you notice. Like, it is really interesting. And I think it does also happen to sex workers in general, because lots of people haven't heard from them. They're often very surprised that they're normal people, that they're mothers, that they're cousins, like they're just people with a job rather than some kind of like magical unicorn or.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, like, in terms of sex workers, in people's brains, they look a particular type of way and they do particular type of stuff. And a sex worker is such an expansive spectrum. And I think people need to look at that more as well, because when you think about sex workers, it's a particular group and they do particular things, and that's the only line of work that is considered as sex work. And that is very problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hugely reductive. Sometimes it's reductive because people think, you know, what they call like the happy hooker myth. Sometimes it's because they imagine your secret diary of a cool girl. You're just a nympho who loves money. They think that, or they think the opposite, which is, oh, you're an addict who's very desperate and a terrible, being abused by everybody. And both of those things are really unhelpful to the reality of people's daily experience.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, as I get older, and just because, you know, like my circles are so expansive and people do and exist in their own truths as much as they can, you know, I know a couple of sex workers and, you know, if you pulled up a picture and said, do they look like this? I can put £100 billion. They don't look like this. You'd never know that they are sex workers. Like, you know what I mean? Sex workers are literally men and women sitting next to you on the tube. And people need to really, like, get to grips with that.
Yeah. Well, I think this is what's so interesting about photography, right? Because it's something I know nothing about at all. But you talking about it and how fundamentally you are changing how people see things or making them see them more truly. Because, like, what you just said... Yeah, people sitting next to you on the tube, you make certain assumptions and they're going to be wrong. And what a photographer can do is go, I'm showing you your assumption.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, basically. But I try with my work personally not to push my view too much. Like, I want people to come to their own conclusions. Or at least, like, create a space where we just have a discussion about it, as opposed to like, hey, I'm Denisha, this is what I think, I want you to agree with me, goodbye.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really good of you, actually, because I'd always be really tempted to go, I'm Sarah, here's what I think, full stop, the end. Don't fight with me.
Because, like, you know, sorry to go back to my man project.
Oh, yeah.
But I was in a residency in Hastings and, you know, had a show and we had a Q&A and there was audience there and this guy called Nigel, that is his name.
Yeah.
He compared my work to Hugh Hefner's lovely porno mag called Playboy. Yeah. And he said that it would be absolutely absurd for him to walk up to a woman and ask her if it was okay for him to shoot her naked.
Yeah.
So for me to do so, it just feels ridiculous for him. And he said that he was really like flustered and, you know, really defensive about photos that are just sitting on a wall.
Yeah.
So I said to him, you know, I don't even know why I'm telling you this story, but anyway, I said to him, it's wild that you compare me to Hugh Hefner, as he only creates the magazines to facilitate desire. And secondly, like, your defense and your distance and uncomfortability looking at the male physique is why I'm doing it. You know, because for you to feel so angry and so uncomfortable with photos I've produced, which ultimately look like you.
Yeah.
Like, that's something that you need to really like look at within yourself.
Well, you're absolutely right.
And thank you. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's what I told him. Then he just avoided me for the rest of the Q&A.
Oh, bless you. I think it's so interesting because actually all learning feels uncomfortable. Like, making people feel discomfort is probably the first sign that they're having to grow a little bit, either what they think about themselves or what they think about other people. But yeah, what you're going to get is defensiveness, because feeling uncomfortable is horrible.
Yeah.
Like, for him, he couldn't see, oh my God, this is the definition of art. It's making me feel stuff. Instead, it was like, stop making me feel. I'm not a Playboy bunny. I'm Nigel.
Yeah, but then it goes back to the beginning of our conversation about patriarchy and, you know, it men and women fall victim to it, you know?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. I was going to ask you had, because I feel like you've been learning so much about men and especially like masculinity as a construct. Do you have any advice? Do you have any advice for men in terms of like accepting themselves?
I mean, just as a disclaimer, I don't know if I have any real advice for any man on the planet.
Yeah.
And I want to say that because I'm a woman, there's only so much I can understand about being a man, you know?
Yeah.
But if there's one thing I could say to any man that chooses to listen to this is, like, your feelings are okay. And they are valid, and expressing them ultimately makes you more of a man. If that is how you see yourself, like being, like your strength is ultimately determined by your vulnerability, and it's okay. That's my only 2 pence I'd want to give.
I think that's a huge thing to say. I think that's such a huge thing because men don't get told that all the time. They don't get told that. I think it's a beautiful thing you just said.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. I wanted to say thank you so much for you for doing the podcast. I'm going to do a little thing at the end, but in terms of people who want to like find your work, you've got your website so people can go to denishaanderson.com.
Yep, that is right. Yep, or you can follow me on Instagram on @Denisha_Anderson. And if there's any men listening or women who are comfortable with letting their men pose nude for me, holler at me.
Yeah. Okay. So people get in contact for that. No rude messages. Don't like come. I heard you on the podcast. Nothing too rude, please. This isn't Grindr. And also, if people wanted to buy the zines, they can do that from your website as well. If they want to buy them.
Great. Yeah. Literally just DM me or send me an email.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to Denisha Anderson. Please check out her work. Please support her work if you can. What a fascinating woman. Next week, I'll be joined by another fascinating woman, Julia Schonstad, who is an award-winning feminist pornographer. See you in 7 days.